Are we ready for it? Yeah. Then you stand up, Dr. Bell. Dr. Drolstein will make the presentation on behalf.
Footage of an elderly Albert Einstein sitting at a table flanked by two other men.
Okay. Say when?
Albert Einstein, the icon of genius. His theory of general relativity is one of the greatest feats of thinking about nature to come from a single mind. It is now 100 years old.
Can you kill the lights, fellas?
Einstein is gently ushered away by his companions.
How do you even study the universe? How can you study everything, all of this mass, all the stuff, all the energy in the universe at one time? Turns out that you actually can do that with Einstein's theory of general relativity.
One mathematical sentence, and from it, you can derive the understanding of the entire universe on the largest scales. And that is beautiful.
How did a theory that explains so much come from one person?
Einstein had a magical talent. He could take a hard physical problem and boil it down to a powerful visual image, a thought experiment.
This is the story of how a young Albert Einstein imagined a series of thought experiments that fundamentally altered our view of reality.
The problems are formulated simply, but it turns out that the answers revolutionize the whole of science.
An actor portraying the young Einstein closes his eyes. Inside Einstein's mind, the enigma of space and time.
The seeds for Einstein's key thoughts were planted when he was just a child. He grew up in a small house in Munich in southern Germany. His unique personality was evident early on.
Like many great innovators, Einstein was a rebel, a loner, but deeply curious. He was slow in learning to speak as a child, so slow that his parents consulted a doctor. But he later said that that's maybe why he thought in visual thought experiments.
Walter Isaacson, biographer.
His sister remembers him building little card towers using playing cards. He was a daydreamer, but he was deeply persistent.
Einstein's father, Hermann, manufactured electrical equipment. He nurtured his son's interest in science. On one occasion, he brought him a compass.
Simon Schaffer, University of Cambridge.
This needle kicks and points you where to go, but you can't see how or why. And that kind of puzzlement is very characteristic of young scientists.
Now, you and I maybe remember getting a compass when we were kids, and we're like, oh, look, the needle twitches and points north. But then we're on to something else, like, oh, look, there's a dead squirrel. But for Einstein, after getting that compass, he developed a lifelong devotion to understanding how things can be forced to move even though nothing's touching them.
The embossed cover of a hardback book.
The young Einstein became gripped by a desire to understand the underlying laws of nature. He developed a unique way of thinking about the physical world, inspired by his favorite book.
The book Einstein loved told little stories like, what would it be like to travel through space or go through an electrical wire? And it made Einstein think visually.
These imagined situations, that we often call thought experiments, became a defining feature of Einstein's thinking.
One of the critical thought experiments that Einstein began to play with very young, at around the age of 16, was trying to imagine what would happen if he could catch up with a light wave. It's one thing to imagine light waves zooming past him at some seemingly impossible speed. But what if he could somehow just propel himself really quickly? What would it look like if he could catch up with that light wave? What would he see?
David Kaiser, Massachusetts Institute of Technology.
He said it caused him to walk around in such anxiety his palms would sweat. Now, you and I may remember what was causing our palms to sweat at age 16, and it was not a light beam. But that's why he's Einstein.
A photograph of Einstein as a teenager.
This dreamlike thought about the nature of light was Einstein's first step on the path to his great theory. It stayed with him throughout his time at school and college.
He was extremely gifted in science and math as a young person and very bad at other classes, mostly because he kept cutting class and being very rude to his teachers. Many teachers from when his high school days on were convinced he'd never amount to anything. He was a discipline problem. I mean, he was bad news.
He applies to the second best university in Zurich, the Zurich Polytech, and gets rejected. I'd love to meet the admissions director who rejected Albert Einstein. But eventually he gets in, and he does moderately well, but not good enough to get a teaching fellowship. And so he ends up at the Bern Swiss Patent Office as a third-class examiner.
Einstein started work at the patent office in 1902, age 23. Here, his job was to assess the originality of new devices.
He was immersed in the kinds of sort of technical details that he had been fascinated by as a very young kid. And here he was sitting in, you know, the kind of wave of the modern age. This was the era of electrification. So all the latest clever ideas for switching technology, for coordinating clocks in particular, those were all passing through his office.
Time zones had recently been introduced in Central Europe, and accurately synchronizing clocks within regions was a major challenge of the day. Switzerland was a world leader in time technology. Dozens of patents to link clocks passed through Einstein's office.
He could whip through these patent applications, and then out of his drawer he'd pull his physics notes, and his boss was very indulgent and would sort of turn a blind eye as Einstein was doing his theories in his spare time.
It's really important to remember that theoretical physics was new when Einstein was a young man. You could do quite a lot of this work by reading a relatively small number of science journals and making the calculations yourself. Einstein's world in 1905 was dominated by two kinds of physics. One was about 200 years old, founded by Isaac Newton, British natural philosopher. For Newton, all there is in the world is matter moving.
A model of the solar system in motion.
Newton showed that the motion of falling apples and orbiting planets are governed by the same force, gravity. His equations are so effective, we still use them today to send probes to the farthest reaches of the solar system. The other important theory of Einstein's day covered electricity and magnetism. That branch of physics had been revolutionized in 1865 by the Scottish physicist James Clerk Maxwell. Maxwell's theory describes light as an electromagnetic wave that travels at a fixed speed.
This prediction that the speed of light will be an absolute fixed value, never faster, never slower, never stopping. That is so surprising, as ordinary things don't have a prediction from fundamental law what their speed is. A basketball can be fast or slow, or it can stop. There's no fundamental fact of the speed of a basketball.
This notion of a fixed speed of light captivates Einstein. He visualizes it in a brilliant thought experiment.
Sitting with his arms folded, Einstein watches as a model railway assembles itself on the desk in front of him.
He imagines a man standing on a railway platform. A lamp turns on. A beam of light rushes past him, and he observes the speed. Then he imagines a train travelling at close to the speed of light.
It rushes past the platform.
A lady on board sees the same beam. Einstein visualizes that in Newton's world, because the lady is moving at close to the speed of light, she would see the beam pass her train window relatively slowly.
the light beam traveling alongside the moving train.
But in Maxwell's world, the speed of light must be the same for both the man and the lady.
From the streaming light to Simon Schaffer.
Einstein could see immediately that there's a contradiction between Newton and Maxwell. They just don't fit together. The reason they don't fit together is that if Newton is right, then if you measure the speed of light, it will be different depending on how you're moving. And what the Maxwellians were saying was the speed of light is always going to turn out the same. Those two things cannot simultaneously be true. And one of the things Einstein hated, was contradiction. If there's one kind of physics that says this, and another kind of physics that says that, and they're different, that's a sign that something's gone wrong and it needs fixing.
Einstein sits at his desk, thinking.
For months, Einstein wrestles with the problem. Eventually, he makes his breakthrough. He focuses on a key element of speed, time.
He realized that any statement about time is simply a question about what is simultaneous. For example, if you say the train arrives at 7, that simply means that it gets to the platform simultaneous with the clock going to 7.
He feels this crucial notion of things happening at the same moment should depend on how you're moving. And that would mean the flow of time might not be the same for everyone.
The hands of a clock.
He explores this radical idea in another thought experiment.
The model train.
Again, he imagines the man standing on the platform. This time, two bolts of lightning strike on either side of him. The man is standing exactly halfway between them, and the light from each strike reaches his eyes at exactly the same moment. For him, the two strikes are simultaneous.
The train approaches and trundles past the model figure of the man on the platform.
Then, Einstein imagines the lady on the fast-moving train. At close to the speed of light, what would she see?
The train moves in slow motion.
As the light travels out from the strikes, the train is moving towards one and away from the other. Light from the front strike reaches her eyes first. For the lady, time elapses between the two strikes. For the man on the platform, there is no time between the strikes.
The train moves on.
This simple thought has mind-blowing significance. If different observers can't agree on what's simultaneous, then they can't agree on the flow of time itself.
If there's no such thing as simultaneity, then there's no such thing as absolute time everywhere throughout the universe, and Isaac Newton was wrong.
The lady on the fast-moving train does measure the speed of light to be the same as the man. Because relative to him, her time runs slower. This concept, that time and space are flexible depending on how you're moving, became known as special relativity. It led to remarkable results, such as the famous equation relating energy to mass.
Einstein published this article in 1905 to exactly no acclaim. Most people ignored it. This was not setting the world on fire. 2 years go by before a very eminent physicist, Johannes Stark, invites Einstein to write a review article on Einstein's own work precisely because no one was paying attention. And he begins thinking about ways to generalize him, to push his own results from 1905. What if he considers not only a train moving at a fixed speed past the platform, what if that train begins to speed up or slow down? What if there's acceleration?
Adding acceleration to the equations was his first task. Then there was that mysterious Newtonian force of gravity to contend with. In Newton's theory, gravity is a force that acts instantaneously. But special relativity says that's impossible. Nothing can travel faster than light.
What Newton's theory tells you is that suppose the sun were to disappear, the orbit of the Earth should change at that very moment. But the notion of at that very moment in two different places is exactly one of these notions that special relativity has told you isn't a good physics notion. So you've now got this challenge of trying to work out how to take the success of Newton's theory of gravity, but fit it into this new special relativistic picture.
Einstein begins to think about how objects fall.
A bowling ball and a feather are released at the same time.
And one of the major features that gravity has was pointed out by Galileo, that everything falls at the same rate in a gravitational field. If you can ignore the effects of air resistance, even heavy objects and light objects, they all fall the same way when gravity pulls on them.
This bowling ball and feather, inside the airless environment of a vacuum chamber, fall in perfect unison.
Einstein figured that if everything falls at the same rate in a gravitational field, then imagining that all you're allowed to do is look at the things around you, you're not allowed to look at the wider world, then you wouldn't even be able to tell that you were falling in a gravitational field because everything would be doing the same thing, whatever that thing was. So Einstein said, well, that's a very strange feature for a force of nature to have. The things that are next to each other can't even tell that that force is there. And again, being Einstein, he started to think, well, what kind of force of nature would have that property? What would it mean for a force of nature to act on absolutely everything in the same way?
Black and white footage of an old roller coaster and children descending a slide.
Einstein feels that there must be an important link between gravity and acceleration.
Robert Digraph, Institute of Advanced Study.
We all know that if when we are accelerated, and of course now we have cars and airplanes to give us the physical feeling. If you're in an airplane and it's taking off, you are pushed back in your chair, you feel actually kind of a force pushing you back, which feels very similar to the force of gravity. But you need kind of the brilliance of Einstein to explain why they are related.
We have another moment here where Einstein is looking at something familiar, but then seeing it in a different way and concluding some remarkable new principles about it.
Suddenly, he hits upon what he describes as the happiest thought of his life. What if gravity and acceleration are really the same thing?
Einstein lights a pipe.
Again, he examines the idea in a beautiful thought experiment. He imagines a man in a box, floating weightlessly in a distant region of space, in zero gravity. Suddenly, the man stops floating and finds himself on the floor. What has happened? Either the box is now close to a planet, and the force of gravity has pulled the man downwards, or someone has attached a rope and the box is now being pulled and accelerated upwards.
The box rising into the air.
So which is it? Gravity or acceleration? Without being able to see outside, the man can't tell why he's on the floor.
Einstein realized that there is no way to tell the difference between sitting in a gravitational field and being accelerated. That these are equivalent situations.
The fact that these two effects are the same, give the same result, means that gravity is acceleration. It's not just like acceleration, it's the same thing.
It's a big breakthrough. by extending his theory of special relativity to include acceleration, he could begin to formulate a new theory of gravity.
Einstein sits writing at his desk. Now, framed photographs on a sideboard, family pictures of a woman holding an infant, and Einstein with his wife. Vintage film footage of cars crossing tram lines.
By 1912, Einstein is living in Zurich with his wife Mileva and two young sons, Hans and Eduard. The academic world had realized the importance of special relativity, and his career had taken off. He's now a professor at the esteemed Swiss Federal Institute of Technology, but spends as much time as possible working on his theory. He needs to describe how objects move in space and time, and soon realizes that the best tool for the job is a strange but powerful concept called space-time.
Jana Leven, Columbia University.
If I think of space, I know that I can find anything if I know where it is, north, south, east, west, and up, down, three points. But that doesn't mean I can find it, because I also have to know where it is in time. And so if we start to think to know everything about an event in the universe, I have to know not just its spatial coordinates, but also its time coordinate, I can begin to think about where it is in space-time.
Imagine a camera filming an action, capturing each moment in time as a single frame.
From Einstein repeatedly rolling two dice in front of a camera to the film footage the camera has captured.
Einstein basically tells us, think of the movie real. And so you have all these little pictures. Now cut them apart one by one and stack them on top of each other. You get this pile, and if you go up in the pile, you go up in time. And now, kind of glue them all together into one big block. And that block has both space and time. And that's the space-time continuum. It's almost looking at a movie, not frame by frame, but seeing the whole movie at once. They would now be kind of two strands going up in space and time, and they would be kind of spaghetti strands. In fact, we all are spaghetti strands moving in this space-time.
Spinning dice.
Einstein feels that space-time is the natural arena in which his theory of relativity should play out. But now he needs sophisticated mathematics.
By your standard or mine, Einstein was good at math. He was Einstein. But he was not really a mathematician, per se. He didn't prove theorems. He didn't pore over math books. He was a physicist. He did thought experiments. He thought of very tangible, concrete situations and what would happen. So when it came time for him to really bear down to the absolute cutting-edge mathematics of his day, he required help.
He has to have a better grasp of how to describe paths of objects as they move through space-time. He needs new mathematics, and he doesn't have that at his fingertips, so he has to go look for it.
Einstein photographed with three other men.
At university, Einstein had skipped the geometry classes, letting his friend Marcel Grossman take notes for him. Grossman had excelled in geometry and was now chairman of the maths department. He suggests Einstein uses advanced mathematics in which the shape of space and time could be curved.
Because space-time has a geometry, he thinks to himself, well, maybe it's the actual shape of space-time itself that is giving rise to gravity.
After months of work, Einstein has an extraordinary idea. What if space-time is shaped by matter? And that's what we feel as gravity.
In struggling to figure out what causes gravity, then, Einstein has this great insight. It is simply that a mass distorts the shape of space-time around it. So we get rid of this force of gravity, and instead we have curvature of space-time.
In Einstein's universe, then, if space were empty, it would be flat. There'd be nothing going on. But as soon as you put objects down, they warp the space and time around them, and that causes a deviation of the geometry so that now things start moving.
A man swinging on a set of flying rings.
Everything wants to move as simple as possible through space and time. But Einstein tells us that mass sculpts space and time, and it's the curved motion through this sculpture as the force of gravity.
We have this feeling that the reason I can feel pressure on the soles of my feet, that the reason things are going to drop when I throw them, are because there's a force attracting us down to the center of the Earth. What general relativity tells you is that's not the right way to think about what's going on there. What's really going on is that your natural path in space-time would take you to the center of the Earth. And what's actually happening is the floor is getting in the way. It's pushing you upwards.
We look at it, we go, ah, the force of gravity. But Einstein says, no, 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 the curvature of space-time.
An ant crawls across some crumpled paper.
It's a stunning insight. Just as an ant might feel forces pulling it left and right as it walks over crumpled paper, when it's simply the shape of a surface dictating its path, Einstein saw that what we feel as the force of gravity is in fact the shape of the space-time we're moving through.
Simon Schaffer.
That move to stop treating gravity as something spooky and inexplicable and start thinking of it as something that's absolutely to do with the very geometry of the world, that then allowed him to begin to complete a general, a universal theory of relativity.
Einstein now has everything he needs to formulate his final theory of gravity. But he makes a critical mistake. He misinterprets one of his equations, and unaware of his error, continues working on incorrect ideas.
The point at which Einstein is going to give the most essential equations of the theory, Einstein considers something like them and then says, ah, but these don't work, and then writes down the wrong equations.
John Norton, University of Pittsburgh.
What follows are alternations of confidence and despair. As he convinces himself that everything is fine with this theory, and then he realizes that things aren't so good with the theory. It is a long, dark period for Einstein as he struggles to reconcile himself with a theory that is just not working.
Einstein's now back at his desk.
2 years later, Einstein is in Berlin. At just 36 years old, he has one of the most prestigious positions in physics. But he is still struggling with his theory.
Archive footage of Berlin, then Walter Isaacson, biographer.
By 1915, he'd reached the pinnacle of the profession. He's in the Prussian Academy and a professor at the University of Berlin, but his marriage has fallen apart. His wife and his two kids have moved back to Switzerland. So he's pacing around almost all alone in this apartment in Berlin.
He changes fundamentally the way that he does his physics. He had relied on physical intuition all the way through here, and he'd let the mathematics take a back seat. He decided that that was a mistake, that he should have listened to the natural mathematics first. And Einstein adopted that new method and started to write down not the equations that he thought were physically the most plausible, but the equations that were mathematically the most natural.
But now he has a competitor. Einstein had enthusiastically shared his ideas with the brilliant mathematician David Hilbert. Hilbert was so impressed, he decided to work on the theory himself. Einstein is now in a race to the finish with one of the world's best mathematicians.
Soldiers marching in a parade.
This is unfolding in a remarkably dramatic period in history.
World War I has begun to ravage Central Europe. Einstein is not just toiling sort of in the abstract, he's toiling as the world seems to fall apart. That affects whom he can send letters to, it affects what journals from other countries he can even receive in the midst of the blockade. The world is, certainly from the point of view of the middle of Germany, is not looking like a bright, happy place. Einstein's feeling dejected because his work is not going well. He's concerned that he's now in a race with a remarkably gifted colleague. His family life is not particularly happy. And the headlines every day scream war, devastation, and carnage.
By November 1915, Einstein is scheduled to present his work in a series of four weekly lectures at the esteemed Prussian Academy. But he's struggling to formulate his ideas. In the midst of this ordeal, letters arrive from his wife in Zurich, pressing the issue of his financial obligations to his family and discussing contact with his sons.
He sits reading a letter.
As his lectures begin, his theory is still far from complete. The pressure on Einstein is huge.
He would give a lecture, revise it, give it again. Spot mistakes, correct them, get up on the podium, explain what was wrong in the previous week's lecture, correct it, and then move on. And then do that again and again for 4 weeks running. His work to convince them of the truth of this absolutely radical new theory of relativity that he was proposing is one of the most intense periods of work in the history of science.
Einstein's fountain pen scrawls across a sheet of paper.
Somehow, he's able to focus on his theory with an incredible intensity. And he makes his breakthrough. He tests his equations on a problem that Newton's theory of gravity couldn't solve: the orbit of Mercury. Mercury's path around the Sun has an anomaly that Newton's theory can't explain. It deviates slightly each time it goes round. Einstein calculates the orbit with his new equations. The answer is correct. Exactly what astronomers had observed. He'd found the final equations for his general theory of relativity.
He strikes a match and lights his pipe. Sean Carroll, California Institute of Technology.
You have to think about the hubris of being Albert Einstein. He had already thrown out Newtonian mechanics with special relativity, and then he had gone off on his little personal quest to incorporate gravity, and at the end of the day, he boils it down to a prediction for a number that had been observed, the precession of the orbit of Mercury. And miraculously, when the pages of algebra work out to their end, you get the right answer. And suddenly, it's not just playing with equations anymore. He realizes this is how the world works. All of this abstract nonsense is the correct theory of reality.
A photographic portrait of Einstein taken during this period of his life.
Einstein is at last able to present a successful theory. That's a triumphant moment, one of the great moments in the history of physics. And for Einstein, a victory very much against the odds. And he'd won.
Equations in a notebook.
On the 25th of November 1915, Einstein lays out his findings in his climactic fourth lecture at the Prussian Academy. He presents general relativity. The theory can be written as a single equation. It condenses sprawling complexities into a beautifully compact set of symbols.
So the formula is really simple. G mu nu equals to
G for the shape of space-time,
C to the fourth,
and T for the distribution of mass and energy.
So this very simple formula captures all of Einstein's general relativity. It's a beautiful, simple equation, but it's a lot of work to unpack the symbols, the mathematical symbols, and see how, in this very simple formula, the whole geometry of the universe is hidden. It's kind of an acquired taste to see the beauty. It's also a signature formula for Einstein. The true mark of his genius is that he combines two elements that actually live in different universes. The left-hand side lives in the world of geometry, of mathematics. The right-hand side lives in the world of physics, of matter and movement. And so perhaps the most powerful ingredient of the equation is this very simple equal sign here, these two lines that actually are connecting the two worlds. And it's quite appropriate, they're two lines, because it's two-way traffic. Matter tells space and time to curve. Space and time tells matter to move.
The equation written upon a blackboard, surrounded by a number of others.
The idea that gravity is the curving of space and time is completely alien to most of us. It's hard to imagine that time itself can be warped. But it's real. We can measure it. The Earth's gravity, the distortion of space and time, reduces the further you are from the mass of the planet. Time flows quicker at altitude. To put this to the test, a team of specialists has placed a highly accurate atomic clock at the top of New Hampshire's Mount Sunapee, 2,700 feet above sea level. After 4 days, they collect their clock and take it down the mountain to their lab.
Two men place the clock in a box and transport it down the mountain on a ski lift. It's driven along a country road, and soon a second clock is being placed on top of the first.
There, they compare it to a second atomic clock that has remained just a few feet above sea level.
Put that one into channel A. Master clock in channel B. You guys ready? This is it, right here. The time interval counter is going to show us the time difference between these two clock ticks. 20 nanoseconds. You can see the time difference between them represented here graphically, of the clock that was up at the mountain for 4 days and our master clock.
Since gravity is weaker at altitude, while the test clock was up the mountain, time ticked faster. It's now 20 nanoseconds, 20 billionths of a second ahead of the sea level clock, just as general relativity predicts.
This is really awesome.
But back in 1915, atomic clocks weren't available. Einstein needed a way to show the world the bizarre features of his theory.
Two spheres representing the Earth revolving around the Sun.
The general theory of relativity made predictions of things which looked really strange. For example, the idea that light bends when it passes near a very heavy body. No one had ever looked for that. No one had ever observed it. Einstein was desperate to get astronomers to make that test.
Einstein's theory predicts that when light from a distant star travels close to the Sun, the warped space around the Sun bends the light's path. In May 1919, the English astronomer Arthur Eddington travelled to the African island of Principe to record images that would show this phenomenon.
Right at the end of the war, Arthur Eddington, very much keen to work with Einstein, first because he took the general theory of relativity very seriously. He was a huge admirer of Einstein, but also because he was a Quaker, a pacifist. He wanted as quickly as possible to, as he put it, solve the wounds of war, to bring the British and the Germans back together.
What Eddington had been able to do was take photographs of stars during a total eclipse of the Sun. So the moon blocked most of the brightness of the Sun, and little pinpricks of light could be seen around the Sun, otherwise would be lost in the glare. And Eddington and his colleagues were able to measure that the appearance of those stars had been shifted compared to where they would have been had that big mass of the sun not been deflecting that light from far away.
Eddington's able to show in November of 1919, just 1 year to the day after the end of World War I, that Einstein's general relativity theory is right and a revolution in science has been accomplished.
Einstein striking a match. Then a newspaper headline proclaims, Einstein theory triumphs.
When the eclipse experiments prove Einstein's theory right, he rockets to fame, not just because he's explained a new way of looking at the universe, but at the end of World War I, you had the predictions of a German scientist be proven right by some British astronomers. And it becomes headlines across the world. New York Times says, lights all askew at the heavens. Men of science more or less agog. This is back when newspapers knew how to write great headlines. But Einstein kind of loves this fact that he is now an icon of science.
Einstein becomes a worldwide celebrity. The icon of genius we still recognize today.
The only person who was more widely known was Charlie Chaplin. And they got on like a house on fire. Chaplin said, the reason they all love me is because they understand everything I do. And the reason they love you is that they don't understand anything you do. Can you explain that? And Einstein said,
a shrug.
But in 1930s Berlin, the Nazi Party is gaining power. As a Jewish scientist, Einstein becomes increasingly caught up in the political unrest.
Einstein's theories became a target. They were deemed sort of aesthetically repugnant to a kind of Aryan sensibility. So people attacked not just Einstein, the Jewish scientist, but they would actually have people denouncing general relativity.
Hitler's face on a poster.
In January, Nobel Prize mathematician Albert Einstein visited California.
He begins to make trips to America, where he is welcomed with open arms.
Germany's loss, America's gain.
And in 1933, he settles in Princeton, taking up a position at the Institute for Advanced Study.
Einstein rises from a chair.
Today, the Institute is headed by Professor Robert Digraph.
He basically was still very much by himself, just actually as he was in Berlin, just concentrating on his deep ideas and struggling with the understanding the universe. Of course, his office was here.
At the Institute, Einstein worked to unify his theory of gravity with the other laws of physics.
Einstein at a blackboard.
With Einstein, you see this phenomena you see with many great scientists, that they climb this very high mountain, and instead of celebrating their success, they privilege to see a much wider landscape, and they see all these mountains behind it. And I think he was very much aware how much still there was to be done. Till the very last days of his life, he was trying to push these equations and find a description of nature, all of nature, in terms of the geometry of space and time.
But general relativity was fading from mainstream science. Physics was now focused on the quantum theory of atoms and tiny particles, a theory incompatible with Einstein's ideas, but one that could be tested in the lab. Most of general relativity was then beyond the reach of experiment. When Einstein died in 1955, aged 76, the wider scientific community presumed his theory had reached a dead end. But they couldn't have been more mistaken.
The best theories in physics always take us to places where the people who invented them didn't imagine. And a truly wonderful theory like general relativity predicts all sorts of things that Einstein didn't conceive of. The theory has a life of its own. We understand general relativity much better right now than Albert Einstein ever did.
A radio telescope swivels on its mount, pointing skywards.
Today, huge telescopes peer deep into the universe. It is general relativity that allows us to make sense of what they see.
Stars wheeling in the sky.
And there's one prediction of Einstein's theory this technology has allowed us to explore that is straight out of science fiction. A black hole.
Kip Thorne, California Institute of Technology.
Everything that we're familiar with in ordinary life is made from matter, but not black holes. Black holes are made from warped space and time, and nothing else. A black hole is an object that is spherical, like a star or like the Earth, with a sharp boundary called the horizon, through which nothing can come out. So it casts a shadow on whatever is behind it. It's just a black, black shadow, unbelievably black.
This simulation shows the distortion of starlight around a black hole. Even though Einstein knew his theory predicted black holes, he found it hard to believe they would really exist in nature. In the 1960s, Professor Kip Thorne worked on the mathematical concept of black holes. The idea made sense on paper, and he began to feel that these science fiction-like objects might actually be real.
Must be here somewhere. It's in one of these piles.
Kip made a bet with fellow physicist Stephen Hawking about whether or not a strong source of X-rays known as Cygnus X-1 was, in fact, a black hole.
Yeah, here we go. Relativistic stars and black holes. Yeah, there it is. So that is a copy of the famous bet. The bet says, whereas Stephen Hawking has such a large investment in general relativity and black holes and desires an insurance policy, and whereas Kip Thorne likes to live dangerously without an insurance policy, that's a good characterization of myself, as much to my wife's chagrin. And therefore, be it resolved that Stephen Hawking bets 1 year subscription to Penthouse magazine is against Kip Thorne's wager of a 4 year subscription to a political magazine called Private Eye, that Cygnus X-1 does not contain a black hole of mass above the Chandrasekhar limit. It's witnessed this 10th day of December 1974, while Stephen is at Caltech with me. We made that bet under circumstances where there was mounting evidence that Cygnus X-1 really is a black hole. Stephen Hawking had a terribly deep investment in it actually being a black hole. And so he made the bet against himself as an insurance policy that at least he would get something out of it if Cygnus X-1 turned out not to be a black hole. Now, the evidence mounded thereafter over the period of the 70s and 80s. And in June 1990, Stephen snuck into my office and signed off on the bet that finally the evidence was absolutely overwhelming that Cygnus X-1 really is a black hole. And Penthouse magazine arrived. He sent me the British version of Penthouse, which was ever so much more raunchy than the American Penthouse, actually enough to make my face turn red when I received it at first.
Gliding through interstellar space.
Today, thanks to concepts built on Einstein's theory, we have evidence suggesting there are millions of black holes in our galaxy alone. And his general relativity tells us more. Just as a collision of two objects produces sound waves, the collision of two black holes generates waves in space-time.
There are huge things in the universe happening, like black holes colliding or stars exploding. Then they create these gravitational waves, waves in the shape of space and time, that travel through the universe at the speed of light. And so right now, the space around me is being squeezed and stretched by gravitational waves just getting here from, let's say, two black holes colliding a billion light years away. But the squeezing and stretching is so minute, I absolutely could not personally detect it. And so what we're trying to do is build an instrument that can.
In Louisiana and Washington State, a vast experiment called LIGO is in the final phases of calibration. It's hoped that laser beams traveling 4 kilometers between precisely aligned mirrors will measure the squeezing of space caused by gravitational waves.
The experiment is able to measure the difference between 2 mirrors at 4 kilometers and 2 mirrors at 4 kilometers plus or minus a 1/10,000th of the nucleus of an atom. Sometime between today and a few years from now, we really expect to have made the first direct detection of gravitational waves to actually record the ringing of the shape of space and time. A direct measurement of pure gravitation. We're not collecting light, we're not talking about matter, we're not talking about anything, just measuring pure modulations in space and time. So it's pure general relativity.
Traveling through the cosmos once more. Of all of Einstein's theory's remarkable breakthroughs, the most profound is that our universe has a beginning.
A dazzling burst of light.
The discovery that distant galaxies are moving outwards and the detection of background radiation from the very start of the universe provided evidence for the Big Bang and a universe that's growing.
With this picture of an expanding universe, there is some natural questions. Is the universe slowing down as it expands? Is it so dense that someday it'll come to a halt and collapse? Will the universe come to an end? These seem like good questions.
To find answers, in the 1990s, Saul and his team studied exploding stars, called supernovae, to track the growth of the universe.
When we made the measurement, we discovered that the universe isn't slowing down enough to come to a halt. In fact, it's not slowing at all, it's speeding up. The universe is expanding faster and faster. In order to explain the acceleration of the universe within Einstein's theory of general relativity, we're considering an energy spread throughout all of space that we've never seen before. We don't know what it is. We call it dark energy. And if so, it would require something like 70% of all the stuff of the universe to be in this form of previously unknown dark energy. So this is a lot to swallow, and you might imagine that at that point you should go back and revisit your theory. The problem is that Einstein's theory is so elegant, and it predicts many, many, many digits of precision that it's very, very difficult to come up with any other theory.
Einstein's description of gravitation in the form of an equation.
For 100 years, general relativity has proven correct time and time again. But Einstein himself knew that his great theory had limits.
The huge problem in theoretical physics now is to combine general relativity, our best theory of space-time and gravity, with quantum mechanics, our best theory of very small things. Two phenomenally successful theories that don't automatically gel with one another.
Bare-branched trees rising up from a flat lawn in front of a Georgian building, part of the Princeton Institute for Advanced Study. Inside the building, several French doors that look out onto the lawn and people studying in a library.
Here at the Institute for Advanced Study, where Einstein worked, the world's leading theoretical physicists are trying to solve the problem Einstein never could. Finding a single set of rules that applies to both the cosmic and atomic scales. A unified theory, the holy grail of physics.
We are now in what at this time is the School of Physics, so here people are still struggling with many of the same issues that Einstein was struggled and are still trying to capture the laws of the universe from this very small to the very large in a single equation. And it's still blackboards that are the weapon of choice.
the brightest minds of the world are coming here to work 24 hours, 7 days a week, struggling to grasp the great mysteries of the universe. And I think we're still driven by the same dream that at some point we can capture everything in elegant mathematics.
100 years after Einstein transformed our understanding of nature, the stage is set for the next revolution.
Quantum mechanics was very different than general relativity. It came about by many people stumbling into it. Maybe that will be the way that we do it next time. Einstein was this singular genius who managed to get gravity right. He didn't manage to get quantum mechanics right. When we finally move beyond Einstein, it might be another singular genius that comes along, someone struggling in a poor school in Kenya right now that we don't know about, or it might be 20 different people with 20 different points of view gradually building brick by brick to finally figure out a more comprehensive view that includes general relativity in it.
A man walking by a roadside near the Institute, then Robert Digraph.
I think the most important thing that you learn from Einstein is just the power of an idea. If it's correct, you know, it's just it's unstoppable. It's extremely encouraging that, you know, he was able, with pure thought, to solve the riddle of the universe.
Saul Perlmutter, University of California.
There are only a few moments in science history where we've had to completely rethink our picture of the world that we live in, and this was one of those moments.
The moment you enter the world of general relativity, you encounter claims, propositions, that are doing nothing less than calculating how much matter there is in the universe, whether the whole of space is curved, so that what we thought was in a way beyond experience becomes a system that can be described, can be tested. That still seems to me to be an absolutely amazing fact.
Einstein sits at his desk, thinking.
Well, you know, you have the huge universe, and it obeys certain laws of nature, but where in the universe are these laws actually discovered? Where are they studied? And then you go to this tiny planet, and there's just this one individual, Einstein, who captures it. And now there's a small group of people walking in his footsteps and trying to push it further. And I often feel, well, you know, this is a small part of the universe that actually is reflecting upon itself, that tried to understand itself.
Einstein with his eyes closed.